Oh, I think her send-off was a little bigger than her husband, so it's kind of interesting the way that works. We're in a series, if you notice, the passage today was Matthew chapter 10, and it's a strange passage. We're in a series where we're going through some of the hard sayings of Jesus, some things that he says that aren't kind of the nice, easy things that we tend to think about when we need them. Jesus does say some very difficult things, and in a lot of ways, it's the difficult things that he says that really shape and show us the contours of our faith. No, if Jesus is simply telling us to love people, I mean, most of us know that. When we're told to love our enemies, maybe that does challenge us a little bit more. But again, we've heard that often. But we're in a passage today that is very, very challenging, as you can tell just from the reading. I don't know if everyone knows this, but for me, when I was in college, I majored in accounting. And obviously not the most exciting major to have. A lot of ways it was boring, and I remember I had this period for a few months where, you know, I was taking some accounting classes, and basically just math and a lot of detail, and I remember thinking to myself, like, I wonder what it would be like to have a career in advertising. You know, I thought that would be really cool. You know, a client comes to you, and you get to use these creative skills. You get to think very creatively, and there's a challenge to it. You know, how would I sell this? How would I advertise this? And I think a lot of it was kind of the opposite of what I was studying at the time. You know, accounting is very structured. It doesn't involve a lot of those things. But, I mean, let's say that we were in that field, if we were advertising agents, like, how would you advertise a new car? And there's a lot of different ways to do that, right? Now, maybe you decide that what you're going to emphasize is the beauty of the car and all of its, you know, features, you know, that all these different things the car can do. Maybe you take a different approach and you say, well, the way that you pitch a car is you pitch how it makes you feel. You know, you take the car out and you start driving on these open roads and how it makes you feel. Or maybe you go another way and you advertise a car by saying, this is how it's going to make your life better. See, if you have this car, you know, then you'll marry this kind of person, you'll have this kind of family, you'll have this kind of life. And if you notice, there's a lot of different ways to do that. Now, if you notice, the passage that we have today, if you go to Matthew chapter 10, if I were to ask you as someone who's in advertising, how would you advertise Christianity? This isn't how you would do it, right? I mean, this is the exact opposite. You know, if you had to pitch it in a lot of ways, you would say, okay, well, let's think about, well, what are some of the wonderful promises of, you know, if I were to pitch it to someone who wasn't a Christian, what would I tell them? And sometimes we get asked that, don't we? You know, how am I going to tell people about what it's like to be a Christian, what it's like to know Jesus? Most of us wouldn't think of this passage. Most of us would say, well, you know, being a Christian, there's so much peace involved, there's so much hope, so much joy. And what Jesus says here says, you know, what I come to bring you is not peace, but a sword. Bad advertising. That's not the way you pitch it. But again, what he says is shocking, but it's very important. You know, again, it gives us a better understanding of what our faith really is. So today, as we go through Matthew 10, we're going to look at three aspects of the faith, and hopefully through looking at this hard saying, we'll see what's there for us. First, we're going to look at the peril of faith. You know, there's a danger or a peril to it. We're going to see the priority of faith, you know, that Jesus calls us to set him in a certain place in our lives. And there's also a paradox of faith. So once again, we'll look at the peril of faith, the priority of faith, and then ultimately the paradox of faith. So first, the peril of faith. What is the peril of being a Christian, of Christianity, of the Christian life? Let's take a look at verses 34 through 36, and this is what Jesus says, straight from his own mouth. He says, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a person's enemies will be those of his own household." Now, just to kind of set us up where we are in this, in the book of Matthew. This is still relatively early in Jesus' ministry. It's after the Sermon on the Mount. And what's happening is he's not in the middle where everyone knows, you know, his message and everyone's heard him and seen him. He's at a point where it's still early, but things are beginning to shift. Now, more and more people are coming out to see him. And more people aren't just curious, they're beginning to want to follow him. So it's this really interesting shift happening. It's also this shift where Jesus is going from simply being this itinerant preacher, a guy who goes from town to town, preaches in the local synagogue or gathers people out in the fields. It's actually a period where all of this is turning into a movement. And you see that in the beginning of chapter 10. What he does is he gathers his apostles and he says, I have work for you to do. So if you notice, it's going from just Jesus teaching place to place to a movement. He gathers his apostles. He says, I'm going to give you the power that I want you to go out to these towns and cities. And wherever you go, cast out demons, heal the sick, and tell them about the kingdom of heaven. And so if you notice, things are changing. It's in this period where everything's changing that Jesus wants to, as people are coming out, as people become more and more interested, as people want to follow him, as this movement is building, it's at this point that Jesus wants to tell them he has a very important message for them. And the message is this. His message is, if you're coming out to follow me, if you're really coming out to follow me, it will be dangerous. And again, that's straight from what Jesus says. He says, it will be dangerous for you. If you want to follow me, it will be dangerous. And that's very counterintuitive. That's not the way most of us would pitch it. If a friend of ours came up and said, you know, I've been reading and I'm kind of curious, tell me, like, should I become a Christian? Like, what are the benefits? Why should I become a Christian? We wouldn't go here. But what Jesus is doing is he's giving a warning, because again, as people are coming wanting to follow him, he wants to make sure that they know what they're getting into. That's a very important part. You know, anything that you do, you want to make sure that you know what you're getting into. Obviously, becoming a Christian, there are promises of peace and joy and contentment. But here, Jesus wants to make sure that that people understand that following him will be dangerous, that following him will be difficult to some degree. And to some degree, the message of the chapter is, if you go back to verse 16 where he talks about persecution, Jesus is warning people who follow that they will suffer. They will face opposition. They will face persecution. They will suffer. And you know, we see that in the history of the church. If you study church history, you go all the way back to the earliest church, what we see is Christianity has always been under persecution, there's always been opposition. A matter of fact, in the early church, what we saw is for Christians, they risked imprisonment. So in the epistles, we see that Peter and the disciples were imprisoned multiple times. They were beaten multiple times. We see that Paul is imprisoned too at different times. And the end of his life, he ends his life essentially being imprisoned for a long stretch of time. You know, so for the early church, they faced difficulties. Not only that, but we also know that they faced execution. You know, we know that there was rampant persecution and that people were put to death. Christians were thrown into, were taken to the, what is that called? Colosseum? Yeah, there. Thank you. you know, that they were thrown to the lions, they were burned at the stake, that they were beheaded. We know historically, we know that all of the disciples outside of one were executed. They were all martyrs. And that was a huge challenge to the church. You go forward in history and you see that that's always been the case. At times things have gotten better, but there's always been persecution. Matter of fact, there's a movie that came out. It wasn't really on my radar, but there's a movie that recently came out called Silence. And if you haven't seen anything about it, go check it out. I haven't watched it, but it's basically Martin Scorsese does a movie about this period of persecution in Japan where essentially tens of thousands of Christians are executed. And all of it comes about because in Japan at the time in the 1600s, there's this fear that this European Christianity is going to come in and essentially take over the country. And so they begin to round up Christians, torture them, and execute them. Terrible period of history. But we see that in the past. We see that still happening today. I've heard a lot of vivid stories about Christians being persecuted on the mission field, and they're still happening today. You would think, no, those things don't happen anymore. I mean, persecution, that's what people use. No, they still happen. Matter of fact, if you get Voice of the Martyrs, you see that there are stories after story after story of men and women, missionaries, of believers, young and old, who are being tortured and executed for their faith. I remember one of the really sad stories that I read was about this this boy grew up in this Muslim country, and I don't remember all the details of why he came to faith, but he became a Christian. And his master was so angry about it that that when his master found out, this boy worked on this small farm, when his master found out, his master took nails and literally nailed his hands and his feet to boards. And this boy had to essentially crawl to the next village to find any help. There's stories about sons, about daughters who are stoned by their own families when they've converted to Christianity. These things still happen, and they will continue to happen. These things don't end. Maybe we don't face that type of thing, but even in our country, we're getting to a point where we as Christians face more opposition, and you could even call it persecution, than we ever have before, haven't we? Now, there is more outright, overt opposition to our faith and to our beliefs than there ever has. If you don't believe that, wait till some march goes on in D.C., go there, and begin to tell people that you're Christian and see if you get shouted down or not. Now, again, that might not put your life in danger, but what Jesus is saying is true. It's not, becoming a Christian in some ways does make your life much, much better, but in other ways, being a Christian means suffering is going to be there, that you are going to suffer more, that you are going to face more opposition, more persecution, that things will get more difficult. And you know, why is that? I have a couple of theories, and I'll give you the most simple one. I think one of the reasons, and hopefully this isn't genuinely one of the reasons, but I think one of the reasons is, I think it could be because people think that we as Christians are judgmental or intolerant. And so some people are just kind of tired of feeling as if they're judged or they're facing this intolerance that comes from us. I think here's the real reason, though, and I think it's connected to that a little bit. I think the reason why we face opposition, why Christianity faces more and more opposition today, especially in our culture, is the people who aren't Christians, people who aren't believers, they instinctively know that God doesn't approve whatever it is in their life. Doesn't approve of their lifestyle, doesn't approve of some of their choices, doesn't approve of all of their morality. And that makes them angry. They might not believe in God, but they feel it and they sense it, and deep in their hearts they know it. And the only way they can deal with that anger is to turn it towards us. I think that's a lot of what's happening. I know for me as a pastor, I've seen a little bit of that. I remember with youth groups, you know, when you deal with people who are younger and younger, they can't hide their feelings as well. I remember with different students at different times, I remember one particular student, he had this period where he was really angry at God. This relationship that he was in didn't work out, and he was really upset, and for whatever reason, he pointed a lot of that anger towards God. And what I began to notice was, the angrier he got at God, the angrier he was at me. You know, it's a very kind of one-to-one kind of correlation. I think that's part of what's happening. I think you have people who, even if they don't acknowledge God, they know he's there. I mean, all of us do. We're built with a conscience. We're created in such a way that we have this sense of God in our hearts. And they know that if there is a God, they know there are parts of their lives that aren't pleasing to him, and that makes them angry. And the only way they can deal with that, the only way they can lash out, is at us. You know, if you are a Christian, or if you're thinking about becoming a Christian, you will face persecution, you will face opposition, you will suffer. Matter of fact, Jesus puts it this way. He says, Jesus lets us know that he is going to face opposition, he is going to face persecution, that he is going to suffer. And if he's going to go through those things, why should his followers think anything less? Right? Now, why do you need to know that? Why is that important for Jesus to tell you? Well, here's why. It's important because a lot of times as Christians, we forget that. we forget that the Christian life is going to be full of opposition, persecution, suffering. And when you forget that, when the difficulties come, we get angry at God, don't we? See, it's important for us to know that. It's important for us to know that being believers sometimes will make our lives much more difficult. And when we forget that, then when those things happen, we get angry. That's one of the reasons why Jesus wants to protect, why he wants to warn people that if they really want to follow him, they need to know what it's really about. And it is going to be. It's more opposition, more suffering, more difficulties, more persecution. But having been a Christian for a long time, it's worth it. But it does have those things. So that's the first thing we see, is we see the peril of faith. There is a danger to faith that if you become a Christian, if you are a Christian, you will face those things. Second thing we see here is the priority of faith. Go into verse 36, and Jesus says this. He says, "And a person's enemies will be those of his own household. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Now, if you notice, Jesus has kind of shifted direction. He says you're going to face opposition, difficulty, and suffering because of society, because of, you know, what happens in society. But he says you're also going to experience it in your family. That if you follow him, you're also going to see that upheaval in your family. That if you become a Christian, it will cause problems in your family. And some of you have experienced that already on small scales. Again, you know, I could tell you story upon story in the last 15 years of missionaries that I know who've worked with Muslims, who've worked in Muslim areas, and they will tell you the exact same thing, that happens. That when a Muslim converts to Christianity, their whole family drops them, shuns them. And that worst case scenario, there are times where their own family turns on them. You know, what Jesus is saying is true. You know, that becoming a Christian will cause problems in your family. Now, hopefully it doesn't, and hopefully it's not something you can't work through, but the truth is that sometimes, you know, becoming a Christian does. Now, why? Why do you think that happens? Well, take a look at what Jesus says here. You know, basically what happens is what Christianity does, what Jesus demands, is Jesus demands to be first in your life. Look at verse 37. He says, I mean, he doesn't mince any words. He says, "Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." You notice what Jesus demands is your love. And, you know, that's a strange thing, right? If you were to go to some group or some church and the pastor were to say this, you know, "I demand your love. You must love me more than you." I mean, that's a weird thing, isn't it? I mean, that's something like a cult leader would say. You know, that's something a megalomaniac would say. It's a very strange thing, but Jesus says it. You know, he says you must love me more than your very family. And it's a difficult thing to fathom. Let me see if I can make sense of this. And why he's able to do this. Now, one of the things that makes Christianity unique, and I think it's one of the things that sets Christianity apart from all other religions, is Christianity ultimately is relational. It's about relationship. Every other religion is about obedience, right? Every other religion. And again, if you don't believe me about that, go to Wikipedia, go to the encyclopedia, buy books on Hinduism, buy the Quran. You can read through that too. And essentially, every other religion is about obedience of some form or some fashion. That's the way you get to God. That's the way you make things right. That's the way you know that you're right. Except Christianity. Christianity says that it's not obedience, it's relationship. Now, if Christianity is about relationship, then what's the currency of Christianity? It's love, isn't it? If Christianity is a relationship, then love is the key. You know, when a religion is about obedience, it's not about love. It's about submission, it's about humility. It's about your will, exerting your will to do the things that you're supposed to do. It's about willpower, and it's about success or failure. And religion like that is cold, right? They're just checklists. You have a checklist, whether it's the Ten Commandments, whether it's the five pillars, whatever it is. And if you want to know how close you are to your God, you simply look down the checklist and you see what you've done and what you haven't done. That's cold. But Christianity isn't like that at all. Christianity does have morality, but the morality is entrenched in a relationship. And you know, because of that, the currency of Christianity is love. Love is at the center of everything that we know, everything we believe, and everything that we are. Now, when Jesus says that we are to love him first, what he's doing is he's, again, it's the currency of Christianity is love, so it makes sense. But what he's saying is subversive. If you notice what he's saying, in a traditional family, what are you taught? Well, in a traditional family, you're taught to love your elders, to respect your elders, to submit to your teachers. You're taught to put family and to put older people first, right? That's the way traditional family works, especially in Asian families. I know in my family, when my dad was alive, I remember if my dad told us to do something, we all had to jump. You know, I mean, I would get a phone call sometimes and my dad would say, we're going to dinner tonight. And literally, I'd heard nothing about it. I'd say, okay, what time? Right? We had to jump. Couldn't question it. Couldn't say, you know what, Dad, I'm kind of busy today. If you said that to him, he'd say, so? You know, that's how it would get. I mean, in a traditional family, that was the priority. Your family, your parents, elders, leaders. That's the way it goes. You know, in a non-traditional family, in a modern family, do you know where love is actually located? It's not that you love your parents, that you submit to them. You love yourself. That's kind of the way it goes. In a modern family, your love is directed to yourself. And if you notice, what Jesus says is subversive for both. He says that the one you were to love is him. The one you put first is him. And you see how radical that is to someone who's modern? To someone who's modern, they say, no, I live for myself. Jesus says, no, you don't. You want to follow me? No, you don't. You want to follow me? You live for me, not for you. And it's subversive. What does he say to a traditional person? He says, no, you don't put your family above me. You don't put your leaders above me. I'm above all those things. And ask, you know, it's subversive. Challenges traditionals, challenges moderns. And you know what? It's absolutely not strange because Jesus demands love, but what is it based on? It's based on Jesus loving us. You see, if Jesus never loved us, then it's a strange demand to make. You must love me, and you must love me more than your parents. You must love me more than your children. Why? The only way that demand makes sense is if he loved us. And if he loved us better than a parent and more than a child. And he does. That's what the cross is all about, isn't it? It's proof that God loves us. And when you know that God loves you like that, more than your parent, more than any child could love you, then when Jesus says, you must love me more, and it begins to make sense, then it's not strange. And that's, again, that's what we see the gospel teaching us. Now, why do you need to know that? Well, I think it's because of this. I think the reason why we need to know that is because a lot of times in our Christian life, we stop living based on the foundation that Jesus loves us. Our faith isn't really about love for periods of time. It's about obedience. And obedience gets cold. I think that's one of the reasons why for us, you know, in your spiritual life, things get cold from time to time because we lose sight of love. I mean, we do that with all things. We do that in normal relationships with our friends, with our parents. We forget how much they love us, and when we do, then problems arise. When we're not appreciative, when we don't remember all the wonderful things they've done for us, then we begin to take them for granted. And same thing happens here. Our relationship with God grows cold if we don't remember that at the heart of it is God's love for us, that God loves us so much that he would even go to the cross for us. And in light of that, that we should then love him more. But that's the priority of faith. The priority of faith, Jesus is saying, if you want to follow me, it means that all other loves will pale in comparison to your love for me, because my love for you pales in comparison to what anyone else has ever shown you. So we see the priority of faith. Third thing we see, and we're going to end with this, is the paradox of faith. Let me read verses 38 and 39. And here at the end, Jesus says, "And whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." Now, I'm going to skip over verse 38. Obviously, you know, Jesus is calling us to suffer, to follow after him, and taking up our cross means taking up our suffering, our difficulties, our things that are burdens, maybe even at times things that God calls us specifically to do that are burdensome. But I want to focus on 39 because something interesting is happening here that I think we don't notice. Jesus says, whoever finds his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And what it sounds like is it sounds like Jesus is saying, you need to be willing to give your life, right? That's what it sounds like. He's saying, if you're willing to give your life, then you will find it. And it sounds like a life full of servanthood and ultimately a life full of sacrifice. That's actually not kind of what's going on here. He's not saying that, you know, that we should be so devoted to him that at a moment's notice we should be willing to sacrifice our lives, to give up our lives. And if we're willing to do that, that proves that somehow we are worthy of what Jesus has done for us or anything like that. Here's actually kind of what's taking place. Matthew 10 has its parallel in Luke. And so we can learn a little bit from that. I'm not going to go from that. I'll just tell you what's there. But in both cases, in this passage and in Matthew's passage, when Jesus says, whoever finds his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. The word that he uses for life here is actually very interesting. He doesn't use the word that's connected to physical life. Right? If he were to use this other word, then he would mean you should be willing to give up your physical life. The word that he's actually using there is connected to the word that we use for psyche or psychology. And using it, Jesus isn't talking about our brains or our necessarily our souls the way we think about it. What he's talking about is this. What the word kind of means is it means our self or our identity. What Jesus is saying here is this. In every culture, there are things that every culture puts out there that says, if you have this or if you are this, then you are valuable. You are someone. Every culture does it. You know, so in a traditional culture, for instance, one of the things they say makes you important or valuable or good is if you're a good son, a good dutiful son, a good dutiful daughter, you know, then you're valuable, then you're worthy, then you're important, then you're right. You know, in the ancient Near East, for instance, let me give you another example of it. In the ancient Near East for women, the thing that made them valuable or important or worthwhile was bearing children. And we see that all through the Old Testament. Now, when a woman bore children, then it meant that things were right. She was really a woman. And what would happen if a woman couldn't have a child? If a woman was barren? Curse is on her. She is cursed by God, right? Now, I want you to notice this. You know, again, Jesus isn't talking about physical life. He isn't saying, you know, whoever finds, is willing to give up his physical life. He's saying, whoever is willing to give up himself. And so what he's saying is this. He's saying that there are a lot of things in every culture, there are a lot of things that you can spend your entire life working towards, trying to gain, thinking that it will make you someone or something, that it will make you valuable or loved or worthy or important. And you know, in our culture, we have those things. You know, for some people in our culture, it's status. You know, you put a D and an R in front of someone's name and they're important, right? They're a doctor. I guess to a lower degree, you could put DDS in front of someone's name, and that has some of the same effect. They're important. Maybe not doctor important, but they're kind of a doctor. For other people, it's bank account, right? I mean, they feel bad, and what makes them feel like they've made it? Their bank account, you know? Or the house they bought, or the things that they have. For other people, it's reputation. You know, it's a different type of status. For other people, it's having, you know, people that they know say wonderful things about them. Then they're valuable. Then they're important. Then their life is worthwhile. And what Jesus says is this. He says, you can spend your entire life looking for, trying to gain that. And at the end of your life, you will have realized that you've lost it all. That it was nothing. You could spend your entire life chasing after those things and at the end say, what do I have? I have nothing. Or you can die to those things. You can say no to those things. And you can say, you know what? What makes me valuable, what makes me important is Christ. And if you're willing to lose all those other things, if you're willing to push them aside and say, those things don't matter, I will not find myself in those things, then you will genuinely find life. That's what Jesus is saying. You look to the world and you look to gain it and you will lose it. But you look to Christ, willing to give up all the other, and you will have it all. Now, that's an amazing thing for him to say. He's not challenging us to be ready to die at a moment's notice. He's asking for something much more difficult, isn't he? He's saying there are so many things that you love, that you hope in, that you trust in, that aren't me, and all those things are trash. But if you're willing to let go of them, you will truly find something worth living for. And that's absolutely true. Even if you've been a Christian for a long time, there are things that all of us are still chasing after. And you know what? Number one, the chasing will never cease. Even when you get it, you will not feel like you have it. Number two, if you don't get it, it will crush you. Here's the funny thing, though. If you do get it, it'll still crush you. Because it means nothing. But if you're willing to give those things up, then you will really find it. You know, as we finish out, I think what's the question that I wanted to ask at the very end is this. Why should you be willing to do that? I mean, why should you be willing to give up yourself, your identity, all these things that the culture says, you know, these things are good, these will make you important. Why should you be willing to do that? Because that's a lot. And that's difficult. You know, the world offers a lot, riches, adulation, you know, all these different things. Even if we know that they're empty, I mean, those things could still be enjoyed. You know, why should we be willing to do that? Well, according to the gospel accounts, the reason why is because Jesus gave up everything for us. Not just his life. Think about it for a second. Jesus never married, did he? No. And in that culture, I mean, that was a big deal. Never had children, huge deal. Jesus wasn't a respectable boy. He didn't grow up to be this respectable man. Matter of fact, at the end of his life, everyone called him a criminal, called him a blasphemer. And at the end, he actually did lose his life. Why would he be willing to do that? Because he knew that if he did that, he would gain us. And you see, the only way and the only reason why you would ever be willing to give up all that other stuff is if you see what he did for you. If you see what he did for you, then you can finally say no to everything else. But that's the only way you can do it. You can't mentally kind of work your way into a lather and say, I'm going to give everything up and not have a reason behind it. Jesus shows us what that reason is. He gave up everything for us. And so when he demands it, it's not strange. When he asks us, when he demands it, it's because he's already done it. And if you know that he did that because he loves you, then it's actually not that hard to say, you know what, Jesus, I'll love you like that too. Let's pray together.